Hey, it's Mike McEntee here on AM 950. Happy Tuesday to you. Repeal the Second Amendment. A former U.S. Supreme Court justice is suggesting it. That's Justice John Paul Stevens wrote an op-ed in the New York Times that's getting a lot of attention. We'll talk about that and also what the polling says about that. Maybe we'll have time here. We'll open up the phones and see what you have to say about that. That's a little bit later on the show. Tonight at 8 o'clock, you can watch a documentary about one of the most important yet least known activists of our time, Dolores Huerta. She was an equal partner, in founding the first farm workers union with Cesar Chavez. And at age 87, she is still fighting. And she's my guest a little bit later on today's show. But first, remember last week that big funding bill that Congress passed? Donald Trump threatened to veto it because he said it had too much of what Democrats want. He eventually signed it. But were there really big victories for progressives in this legislation? Joining me to figure this out is Executive Vice President for Policy at the Center for American Progress, as well as a former Deputy Assistant to President Obama for Economic Policy, Jacob Liebenluft. Jacob, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
The big drama about this bill was DACA, and that did not end well. It didn't. We did not get the protection for hundreds of young immigrants who were brought to this country by their parents. But there were wins in this bill, weren't there?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think many of us had been pushing for Congress to address the DACA issue, an issue that, of course, was created by President Trump. And I think it's really an outrage that this issue hasn't been addressed. Having said that, if you look at just the pieces of the bill around government funding, what we see are a number of places where the increase in domestic spending across the board resulted in some real progressive wins. And in addition to that, we see some specific areas around workers' rights and gun violence prevention, for example, where we have modest wins to build off of, where activism, I think, by progressives helped move Congress in the right direction.
Well, let's get into some of the specifics, because I don't think a lot of people have heard about these things. This was a huge, thousands of pages, I think, of a bill, at least if you believe what Donald Trump piles up there in terms of the paper. Sometimes you have to wonder about that. But in there were provisions that protect workers against tip stealing. And I know we've talked a lot about that on this program, where there's been a move to have employers basically pool the tips and dole them out and in the process keep part of them. What was decided or put forth in this legislation that Donald Trump signed?
Well, you exactly described how outrageous the regulation that had been put forward by the Department of Labor was. This, as you said, would have allowed low-wage workers who really rely on these tips to see their tips, in many cases, taken away by their managers, by the owners of the companies they work for. And I think the intention of DOL and the Trump administration had been to put this rule out below the radar. And what happened was a combination of activism and investigative journalism showed the consequences of this bill, of sort of this regulation on the part of the Trump administration. It showed the fact that they were trying to hide the impact it would have on workers. And that outrage led to a provision in this bill that made, as a matter of law, the principle that employers cannot pocket workers' tips. So that basically undoes that Department of Labor proposal and really codifies in law this important protection for workers.
And you mentioned that when it comes to gun violence, at least we have some positive steps. We've kind of been at a stalemate here over the Second Amendment. I mentioned that over at the beginning of the show. There's an op-ed actually from a former U.S. Supreme Court justice calling for it to be repealed. That's not this legislation, but you're saying there's some positive steps forward. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so in particular, after a shooting in Sutherland Springs, Texas in 2017, we saw a bipartisan effort to strengthen the background check system, and in particular, make sure that different agencies within the federal government were communicating with one another when there was something in their records that suggested that somebody should not be able to purchase a gun under the law, and also make sure that state agencies were providing these records as well. A proposal that improves that information sharing and strengthens the background check system was included in this bill. This was a bipartisan idea that had been floating around on Capitol Hill for a while. So that's a good step, and I think it shows some progress on addressing gun violence prevention, but it really does still fall far short from what Congress needs to do. I think, you know, we've identified actions that could be taken, like banning assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, ensuring that we are, getting guns out of the hands of domestic abusers, and really further strengthening the background check by requiring a background check for every gun sale. Those are the kinds of measures that would, I think, more seriously address the problem. But there's no question that what was in the bill was at least a step in the right direction.
Because we've taken at least a step in the right direction, is it likely that some of those other provisions that you just talked about might get a hearing, might get some serious consideration on Capitol Hill, or are we still so deadlocked on this, people are afraid to do anything?
Well, you know, I hesitate to predict too much, because I think if you look at the March for Our Lives that just happened last weekend, we are seeing a vocal, mobilized coalition from different diverse communities across the country really speak out about this issue. Now, is that enough to move Congress right now in this term? I think there's a lot of reason to expect that it may take more political change for that to happen. But I do think even these modest steps show that it's possible to make progress, and I think what it also does is it takes the lowest hanging fruit off the table, and it requires legislators to basically come forward with now more robust and aggressive measures if they want to really take on this problem. So I think it's good that this measure that had already had bipartisan support moved forward, but I think the real question is, where does the outcry that's been amplified since Parkland take us?
One of the things that determines more than anything else how well somebody does in life economically is their education, and higher education often seen as a ticket to the middle class. This bill, did it do anything to help improve that? Because we've seen that higher education here has become way more expensive than a lot of people can afford, and also, there needs to be investments made in that system. What was in the bill this time?
So this bill included about a $2 billion increase in spending for higher education, and in particular, increasing access to financial aid. One proposal in particular, which was increased, provides support for parents who are in college for childcare, which is, if you look at one of the reasons college students often drop out, it's because they're young parents who are struggling to balance caring for their kids and getting their education. So this is a really positive move in the right direction, even if there's more to do to make college affordable. And I think it also points to something else that's happening across this bill. The reason we see more money for higher education, for child care, for a lot of our key priorities in this bill is because after several years of Congress cutting and cutting domestic spending, there was an increase in this year's bill for domestic spending. And the truth is, if we're going to invest in the things that help working families, that grow the economy, we do need to be willing to put the money on the table for that. And this bill finally did that because of the negotiation that Democrats did earlier in the year.
We're picking through the spending bill that President Trump reluctantly signed last week with former Deputy Assistant to President Obama for Economic Policy, Jacob Liebenluft. One of the things that's in here as well that I've heard from our Secretary of State here, Steve Simon, that he's very happy about is that there's money here to invest in Americans' election systems. And that's really important because we hear about the hackers. We hear about, obviously, Russia. And Russia is more has been more of an influence on Facebook and advertising. But there's real concern here that the actual election systems, the mechanics, the way that people vote could be hacked. What's been done in this bill to protect that?
So this bill had about $380 million to go towards election security. And this provides states with the resources that are necessary to, as you say, strengthen our election systems preparedness when we face a set of threats, in particular from abroad. My colleagues at the Center for American Progress put out a report earlier this year that looked at every state and how prepared they were for potential breaches of election security. So, for example, how much coordination they were doing with federal agencies to identify threats, whether they were had minimum cybersecurity standards, whether they had a verified paper audit trail, things like that. And what we found was that many states were just woefully unprepared for the kinds of threats that we've seen in the past and what we might see going forward. No state received an A under our grading system, and we saw 17 states getting a D or an F. So this money, I think, is a really important first step for states to address some of their vulnerabilities. That's, of course, contingent on states actually taking the steps they need to.
Now, President Donald Trump was not too happy signing this bill. He said the Democrats got too much in it. Although one of the things that he's been championing is apprenticeship programs. And there's money in here for apprenticeship programs, but not exactly the kind that the Trump administration has been pushing for. Tell us about that.
Sure. So the bill provides $145 million to expand apprenticeship programs. And this really builds off some of the work we did in the Obama White House to expand what's called registered apprenticeships, which have sort of labor standards that are applied across the board and that really have a proven track record in helping workers find and develop the skills they need for high-paying jobs. And I think we've seen some bipartisan support for apprenticeship, which is great. But I think what this bill shows is the only way you can actually push the apprenticeship issue forward is if you provide the resources you need. And so in many ways, the Trump administration is trying to say two things on apprenticeship. It's saying we want to support it, but we don't necessarily want to put the money that we need to make it happen. And this bill, in some ways, called the administration's bluff. It said, okay, if we're going to support apprenticeships, let's make sure we're spending money to do it and to do it right.
We've been hearing a lot from the pollution the environmental agencies here that the Trump administration has been running, that they're kind of stepping back from enforcing various rules. This spending bill didn't talk about those rules, I don't think, but it's we have some actual positive news about clean energy, environmental programs, and the public lands that the Trump administration has been trying to restrict as well. What was in the bill here that's good news on those fronts?
The best news in the bill on the clean energy and environment side is what didn't happen. If you looked at President Trump's budget, if you looked at what congressional Republicans have proposed, they've advocated for deep cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency, to the Department of the Interior, to the Department of Energy, and those cuts would ultimately really limit our ability to do everything from clean energy research to protecting public lands. And what this bill does is provide, funding, it avoids those cuts and actually has additional funding for things like cleaning up toxic pollution and wildfire suppression programs. Now, that is only part of the battle. What this bill is not able to do is prevent some of the most harmful regulatory actions that are being taken by people like Scott Pruitt, the director of the Environmental Protection Agency. You know, a lot of the efforts we see to roll back Obama administration era protections or even clean water and clean air protections that stretch back much longer, that still can in many cases be done by the administration. And so it's a good thing that we're not seeing some of the deep funding cuts we feared, but I think the fight goes on against some of the worst regulatory actions that are being taken by the administration.
Now, here today in Minnesota, our governor, Governor Mark Dayton, was in front of the press saying that the legislature needs to act because the programs that we have started here for giving voluntary pre-kindergarten programs, free voluntary pre-kindergarten programs, may be cut or may not be refunded or funded again unless the legislature acts. Early childhood education is, you know, obviously a big priority of the Dayton administration. From the federal side, are we seeing anything in this bill that's going to help with early childhood development?
Yeah, one of the best pieces of news out of this bill was a big increase in federal child care funding. We saw an increase of about 80% of the portion of child care spending in this part of the budget, which is about $5 billion, or gets to a total of about $5 billion in 2018. Now, we see this as just the start. If we were going to guarantee child care assistance for every working family, we would need to provide significantly more resources, and my colleagues have put out a proposal to do that that's been introduced by Democrats in both the House and the Senate. So there's a lot further we could go, but I think this is a real positive step. And again, it's a case where perhaps kicking and screaming, we are forcing Democrats in Congress forced the administration to put its money where its mouth was. We've seen the president and Ivanka Trump in particular really talk a big game about investing in child care that hasn't been matched with the policies that the administration has put forward. This at least creates a down payment towards what we would view as real action in those areas. So again, it may be the parts of the bill that in some ways the president seems angriest about, but they are real down payments on at least rhetorical things the administration likes to talk about.
Now, this bill takes us, I think, through September of next year, so that's when we'll have our next threats of government shutdown or whatever will happen there. But not included in the bill, as we mentioned off the top here, was anything to do with DACA, protecting Dreamers. Where is that going these days? Is there any hope that something's going to get resolved on that from your standpoint?
Well, right now, obviously, we are waiting for this issue to work its way through the courts, and there is a stay that has provided at least sort of a temporary relief to DACA recipients. But this is an issue that Congress needs to address. It's an issue that is only on the table again because President Trump created this uncertainty for the hundreds of thousands of Dreamers nationwide by ending the program last year. But now that the president has done that, it is on Congress to come to a solution. So I think the question is, when that will happen. We've seen really, I think, little serious action on the part of either the president or Republican leadership to address this issue. Every time they claim to want to come to a DACA solution, they do so with what I would describe as poison pills, demands for other immigration measures that are so cruel that they could never be accepted by the other side. And so, what we've seen and what's clear in the president's rhetoric and the president's claim that he wants to solve this problem is that the political pressure is making a difference. There is a need for Republicans, a need for Donald Trump to claim that they are on the side of the Dreamers, but the facts obviously bear out otherwise. And what that suggests is it will take further political pressure to make something happen.
All right. We've been speaking with Jacob Liebenloof, there we got it out, with the Center for American Progress. You can find more over at americanprogress.org. Jacob, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
One of the things not included in that budget bill we were just talking about has Wolf supporters cheering. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. But first, she's been fighting for unions longer than most of us have been alive, and she's not about to quit. We'll talk with the legendary Dolores Huerta just hours before a documentary about her life makes its network debut.
Located just north of 50th and France, the Great Wall Restaurant has provided a delicious taste of authentic Chinese cuisine since 1981. Specializing in Sichuan and Peking dishes, they offer one of the most extensive menus in the Twin Cities. Favorites include hot and sour soup, pan-fried dumplings, and mushu pork with homemade Chinese pancakes. Stop by their Edina location or call for takeout at 952-927-4439. See the full menu at greatwallrestaurant.us.
Believe it or not, it's time for spring cleaning. Okay, it's a little bit early to call it spring cleaning, but it's your last chance to save huge on carpet cleaning from Zero Res. With their patented powered water, your home will smell fresh and clean and not like a janitor's chemical closet. And this month you can get 3-room Zero Res clean starting at $129. Plus, this month you can still get a great deal when you get your air duct Zero Res clean. Call 952-ZERO-RES or visit ZeroResMN.com. Zero Res, spell it backward or forward, it spells the same.
While shopping for a fireplace insert at Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces, I was amazed at all the choices. Not just gas, electric, or wood-burning, but also built-in or freestanding, and options in every style from antique to modern. The staff really listened to us, explained the options, and helped us choose a fireplace we absolutely love. Now it warms our hearts and our home every winter. Thank you, Woodland Stoves, for a great addition.
Hi, I'm Peter Solak, putting in a word for the EPA Burn Wise campaign. It has important information about clean burning fireplaces. This is an important part of our mission at Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces. We know that the fireplace has to work. Work with your life, work with your living space, and also be environmentally smart. Come see us. Learn to burn wise. We have over 35 working units on display at the corner of Riverside and East Franklin Avenue in Minneapolis. Visit our store in person or online at woodlandstoves.com.
Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces, out of the ordinary products and services since 1977.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again.
Welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show. Joining us now is Dolores Huerta. She's somebody that you probably haven't heard of. She's one of the most important yet least known activists of our time. She is very much part of the first farm workers union with Cesar Chavez. She joins us now to talk about a new film that's coming out about her life. Dolores, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
Good to have you on here. For folks who aren't familiar with you, tell us how you figured into this story.
Well, I started the union with Cesar Chavez. Both of us came out of a community organizing a group that we belonged to called the Community Service Organization that had many chapters throughout the state of California where we passed many important laws. And many of the members of that group were farm workers and, you know, seeing the dire conditions that they were living in, and Cesar had been a farm worker himself, and so that we made a plan to really start a union. We had both of us had actually helped other labor unions, you know, trying to organize farm workers and fold them into other unions, but it didn't work, and so that's when we decided to leave the prior organization and start the Farm Workers Union back in 1962.
1962, and of course, a lot has happened then. As you look at today's environment for unions, are you heartened that there's a future, that the unions can continue to be strong, or are you concerned?
I think we're all concerned what's happening with labor, and I think people forget that, you know, how did we get the eight-hour day? How did we get safety standards and Social Security, public education, unemployment insurance, disability insurance, workers' compensation? We got it through organized labor and workers who actually worked very hard, and some people who were actually killed in trying to get some of these basic benefits that we all enjoy. And but now there's a big push to get rid of labor unions, and that, of course, is going to have a really big effect on our whole society, because labor unions are the ones that create the middle class. The middle class is what creates a democracy. So if we don't have labor unions, our democracy is threatened.
So how do you think people can fight back against that? Because a lot of people aren't in unions. The union membership is lower than it's been, although it's been rising recently. How do we fight against that to prevent losing all those things that you just mentioned?
Well, one basic way, and that's by voting, because it's the politicians that are anti-labor that are creating all of these issues for working people. And so we've got to get some of those people voted out of office and get people elected that are going to fight for the working people, that are going to fight for labor unions.
Now, as I mentioned, there's a documentary on Independent Lens about your life called Dolores that will be premiering on Tuesday, March 27th on PBS. You obviously were involved in this. You've seen how they've gone through your life. When you look at your life, what do you see as the most memorable point in it?
Well, I think just reflecting on my life, realizing that I had the courage to get out there and do the work. And even though I had many criticisms from my family, I was a teacher, and I left teaching to, start the Farm Workers Union with Cesar Chavez. And many of my families and my friends thought I was crazy to do that. But leaving a secure position to go organize farm workers, not knowing where our next meal was going to be coming from, it was a very good decision that I made, and I think that's what all of us, as a lesson that we need to learn, is that we got to give up some of our time, got to give up some of our resources if we want to make the world a better place. It's not going to happen by itself. If we don't engage, if we don't get out there and vote, campaign for good people, then nothing changes. Everything stays the same. And so all of us have to take that responsibility very, very seriously, especially in these times that we're living in now.
We've been speaking with Dolores Huerta. You can watch the film on PBS this Tuesday, March 27th. Dolores, thank you so much for sharing your time and your wisdom with us.
Well, thank you very much. And if people want to learn more about the work that we're doing with my foundation, we're on the web at DoloresHuerta.org. And that's DoloresHuerta.org.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
And that documentary about Dolores Huerta, again, is on TPT, that's PBS here in the Twin Cities, Channel 2, tonight at 8 o'clock. Up next, though, on the Mike McEntee Show, a proposal that could prevent a lot of injuries to dogs. And wolf fans are very happy with what's not in the big spending bill Donald Trump signed last week. We'll check in with Howling for Wolves all about that next here on the Mike McEntee Show. You're listening to AM 950.
Hi, it's Tom Hartman. You know, Continental Diamond is special for a lot of reasons. The owners are Jimmy and Helene Pessis, a husband and wife team who had a dream to open their own store more than 30 years ago. They've built a business that is the gold standard. The readers of Minnesota Bride magazine have named Continental Diamond the best jeweler for the last 7 years. Why? Amazing, friendly, no-pressure customer service, a selection of fine diamonds and design jewelry unlike anywhere else, and the fresh-baked chocolate chip cookies are pretty great, too. Continental Diamond in St. Louis Park and at ContinentalDiamond.com.
Lowry Hill Meats, your neighborhood full-service butcher shop that works directly with family farms. Using whole animals gives Lowry Hill Meats the benefit of preparing custom cuts and dry aging. They offer beef, lamb, goat, pork, and poultry, including whole duck, roasting hens, turkey, quail, pheasant, and Cornish hens. Their sausages are made fresh in-house weekly using 40 rotating recipes. Try their handcrafted sandwiches. They are second to none. Lowry Hill Meats is located at 1934 Hennepin Avenue in Minneapolis or online at lowryhillmeats.com.
Tap Taste and Treasure at Vinaigrette, where we have some warm seasonal recipes all ready to create dynamite meals. Our fig balsamic vinegar pairs perfectly with roasted Brussels sprouts or baked brie. And sweet potatoes are always a winner, but never more than when they're roasted with a drizzle of vinaigrette cinnamon or orange-fused extra virgin olive oil on top. Come in today for more custom-crafted food and cocktail recipes at Vinaigrette, 50th and Xerxes in Minneapolis and 287 Water Street in downtown Excelsior. Online at vinaigrettemn.com.
The Spring St. Paul Art Crawl, presented by the St. Paul Art Collective, will be running April 27th, 28th, and 29th. This is a must-do experience that you will love. Over the weekend, you'll have the chance to explore a wide variety of art while touring through local artist studios, lofts, and galleries. Hosting over 350 artists, up for purchase will be paintings, photography, pottery, sculpture, fiber arts, and more. The Art Crawl sprawls over 34 locations. Join the Art Crawl and discover outstanding art for you to own. When you buy local art, you're providing to artists so that they may continue to create the art we love. The Metro Transit is supporting the local art community with free transit passes. Download your pass to ride buses and light rail for free during the Art Crawl. Be sure to get details at the stpaulartcrawl.org. That's the stpaulartcrawl.org.
It's a beautiful day.
Hey, it's Mike McEntee back with you here on AM 950. A little earlier in the show, we were talking about the spending bill that Donald Trump reluctantly signed last week, saying there was too much in it that the Democrats liked. Well, there was stuff in it that, where I should say there was stuff that was not in it that folks here in Minnesota liked. Dr. Maureen Hackett, president of Howling for Wolves, joins us right now to talk about that. Dr. Hackett, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me, Mike. Yes, we were very happy that delisting wolves was not part of that spending bill, and we did know that it was in both versions of the bill right up until Wednesday of last week, and that it was that portion was pulled out at the last minute. We found that out later, at least through the press. That's what they're saying. So
when you say,
we're happy because the bill had bad precedents in it, too. A lot of people don't realize there was a portion of the bill that said there shall be no judicial review of this. Basically, it was ordering the Department of the Interior to reissue a new rule back to the delisting of the wolf in 2011. But it never said the word wolf, and it never said endangered species. It was kind of a hidden little leftover, really, from 2015. It was the same language. And I think now that people see how much we need the courts to make a bill that had no judicial review and allowing Congress to choose what laws could be legally challenged was it really should have raised, you know, fire alarms for everyone.
Now, when you say delisting, that's shorthand for delisting as an endangered species for folks who have not been following this. How long has the wolf been on the endangered species list?
Well, the wolf was the first mammal placed on the endangered species list in 1974. And really, what I've learned when I started, since starting this organization, was that the wolf really was like the symbol of the environmental movement, because if you weren't going to protect the wolf, which was seriously in trouble, we were the last state with a wild population in the lower 48, you know, there was pretty much a battle to get the wolf on the list. There was the same opponents of the wolf now were opposing listing the wolf back then, and it really was a watershed moment to put the wolf on the endangered species list. Unfortunately, very nefarious interests have worked to get the wolf off the list since 1978, really, here in Minnesota. A lot of people don't realize that, but we've learned through all the studying we've been doing that it has been what's been going on.
Well, what's happened to the wolf population since it was put on the endangered species list, and who are those nefarious forces that want it off?
Well, the nefarious forces are special interest groups that don't want to have an endangered species controlling what they do with their land. So it's extraction industries such as oil and mining. It's the gun industry, the NRA. It's the big trophy hunting, Safari Club International. They all petitioned to delist the wolf from the endangered species list along with to the Fish and Wildlife Service many times. But in terms of the numbers, I previously told you about a short video we made explaining how wolves are estimated. You would think that there was some process that was somehow confirmed in reality, that the numbers had any basis in reality, and there really isn't. So there is no process that's been done, even though the technology has far advanced since the 70s. We're still using, a method that if... I won't even go into it. People need to look at our video and realize our video, which is only 3 minutes long, that it's worse than our video shows. We had thought that they were using all the data and evaluating all the data, and now we're finding out that they're picking and choosing even amongst this poor estimation process. So that's the problem with wolf counts. But what we do know is that wolves control their own numbers. They don't need to be controlled except for conflicts. And so that's what we're trying to emphasize, is that we understand that there may be wolf-livestock conflicts, wolf-people conflicts. We get that. But we don't need to go in and kill wolves offensively in some management, mismanagement-guided theory that somehow we need to control a predator population. Predators have a hard enough life. They have competition amongst each other. They don't reproduce if they're under stress. They die out if they can't get enough food. Predators don't. They control their own numbers.
Now, we still have a wolf hunt on the books here in the state of Minnesota, don't we?
We do. Basically, the wolf hunt would take effect as soon as the wolf is removed from the endangered species list, and that's a big problem because the wolf, when the wolf loses protections, the wolf dies in many ways. It's not just through a hunt. There are so many ways that people can kill wolves, and they are killed, that originally a five-year moratorium was agreed upon by pro-wolf people because it was a compromise. And it was an attempt to see, well, what does... And it wasn't that there would be a hunt in 5 years. It was there would be consideration after 5 years following, you know, good scientific surveys and understanding how all the wolf killing that would take place under loss of protections would affect the population. But now we see that really, there's no reason for a wolf hunt. And in fact, the wolf hunt brought out hate. You know, a lot of wolf hate was really ramped up when those wolf hunts were started. And we don't want to see that again. We think we have a different paradigm. We need a paradigm shift. And that people need to understand that, you know, we as a society can grow if we understand how we can allow the wolf to live.
So just to understand that correctly, right now we don't have a wolf hunt, but if it's taken off the endangered species list, there's a five-year wait, or it starts immediately?
It starts immediately. The five-year wait was lined out by Governor Dayton in 2011, which prompted all of this activity for us to try to fight the hunt, because they started a hunt the very year that the wolf lost federal protections. Because during this 2011 budget showdown, the governor lined out the five-year moratorium.
Now,
so we would like to just get the wolf hunt off the books, and if a wolf hunt is proposed again, have them go through the regular process, because the wolf is still an endangered species and still very vulnerable. We're hearing people who've had wolves near them for 30, 40 years. As they came back, they've disappeared again, and so we don't know what that means, but we've heard that out of Ely, and now we're starting to hear it out of the Walker, Minnesota area, and that's concerning.
Now, we're already, I think, close to the halfway point here on the legislative session. It's a short session. A lot of deadlines have already passed, so it's tough to get new legislation in there right now. But you have a couple of ideas and bills that are pending that you'd like to see maybe attached to something else that still might get consideration. I was kind of teasing this before we went to break, is that there's one of your proposals that actually owners of dogs would be very happy about, because it should make their dogs safer. Tell us about that.
Yes, we want to make the woods in general safer by removing snaring. We have recreational snaring in our state, and many animals are injured and killed, especially, you know, pets, but also songbirds, even moose, and, of course, the wolf and other wildlife. So we would like to ban all wildlife snaring. It's been done in 20 other states, and essentially it would be a way to have our wildlife for other purposes besides killing, but also remove these landmines that sit in our woods basically all year round, because they're not necessarily collected. They're very tiny and hard to see. They're inexpensive, and they're put out by the hundreds by each trapper. So we would like to ban all wildlife snaring, and we have a bill that has bipartisan authors, including Representative Loon out of District House 48B, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Or no. I think
on the western suburbs, though. She's part of the
right.
western suburbs.
And then we also have another bill that really actually passed the Senate but then got pulled out in conference committee last year, and that was to require written permission to trap on private lands. Right now, unless you have signs that are posted every 50 feet or maybe 50 yards. I forget I think it's 50 feet. Every 2 years reposted. If you don't have these signs up, if people don't see these signs, they can go on your property and set traps. And they can do other things too, but we feel that traps, that people should have the right to know when traps are being set on their property.
I would certainly be interested in that, especially if I had woods behind my house that I owned and wanted to make sure that maybe my kids weren't going out there, because, I mean, what you describe here with snares, I'm not that familiar with them, but it sounds like it could be a threat to small humans as well as small animals.
Well, depending on the trap, for sure. But, yeah, absolutely. And some people actually want to have large swaths of land for wildlife. You know, that they like the fact that wildlife lives on their property, and if they knew that somebody was coming and taking and killing their wildlife without their permission or knowledge, which is what happens. And we know that it happens because the trappers have admitted such. In some of the conferees in the different committee hearings, they have said, well, this will affect our ability to get to trap as much, because they're going on people's lands and they are trapping.
Now, down at the legislature, typically every year you've held a Howling for Wolves Day, a Wolf Day. Is that coming up here yet in 2018?
Yes, April 11th. I need to give a shout-out to everybody who's thinking of coming to please RSVP on howlingforwolves.org for Wolf Day. We are focusing on snaring this year, and we would love to have a big turnout, and we're going to be talking about also some of the information about how they estimate wolf populations and some of the flaws in that. And it's going to be an information-loaded day, and we will get meetings with legislators and advocate for making our woods safer. The really good part about banning all wildlife snaring is, and this doesn't count for, like, you know, DNR doing what they're doing for certain control measures. This is for recreational snaring. The good thing is that everybody knows after a while, they'll know what a wire noose is. That's what a snare is. And they could, if they saw one, take them out of the woods, because the DNR cannot enforce all these rules about trapping. But if people know that a snare is illegal, they can help clean up the woods and make them safer.
All right. We've been speaking with Dr. Maureen Hackett, Howling for Wolves. She's the president. You can watch that video she was talking about on how wolves are counted or not counted over at howlingforwolves.org, right? Howlingforwolves.org.
Yes, it's called Miscounting Minnesota Wolves. It's on the front panel, and it's only 3 minutes, but it gives you an idea, and you really understand why we could be overestimating our wolf population by massive amounts just based on what they're doing and how they manipulate these numbers. It's quite scary, actually.
All right. Well, Dr. Hackett, thank you so much for joining us today.
You are very welcome. It has been my pleasure. You take care.
Okay, take care. Repeal the Second Amendment. Former Supreme Court Justice is making a case for that. It's an op-ed in the New York Times. I'll read a little bit about it here when we come back after the break. But I want to know what you think about it, too. 952-946-6205. Is it time to repeal the Second Amendment, or is that dangerous talk? We'll get into that. We'll hear what the White House has to say about it, too. That's all next year on The Mike McEntee Show.
This is Pat with PJW Automotive in New Brighton. I've been in business long enough to know that if you want to stand out, you better be the best. That's why I've assembled a top-notch team of automotive specialists who do the job right the first time. Bringing your car or truck to PJW Automotive is an investment in the future of your vehicle. Try us once and you'll see it's worth the drive to PJW Automotive. One exit north of 694 on 35W and online at pjwauto.com.
Hi, Matt McNeil for Rudy Luther Toyota. My first Toyota love was the RAV4 back in 1998. When I was traveling in February, I needed a rental car, and I jumped at the opportunity to drive one again. The RAV4 is fantastic with all the bells and whistles you need, and it has all the modern safety features to keep us safe, comfort as we vacationed. It fit all five of us and our luggage with ease. I was able to revisit my first love. Now, you can fall in love for yourself by test driving a RAV4 today at Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169.
Hi, this is Gregory Rich from Habitation Furnishing and Design, and I'd like you to tune in to a new program, Drink in the Style. Sundays at 5 p.m., Drink in the Style is going to be a one-hour conversation about interior design and aesthetics, all while enjoying a cocktail created by a local mixologist. Drink in the Style, Sundays at 5 p.m., brought to you by Habitation Furnishing and Design.
The fine folks at Common Good Books will help you find the perfect book for you or the book lover in your life. Find a huge selection from a locally owned and independent bookseller in the Twin Cities. They are always bringing in top authors from around the globe for special in-store events. Open Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. and Sundays, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Find Common Good Books at 38 South Snelling Avenue in St. Paul or shop online at commongoodbooks.com.
Welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show here on AM 950. Repeal the Second Amendment. That is the title of an op-ed from former Justice, John Paul Stevens. He talks about how great it is that young people have gotten engaged on trying to do something about gun violence, about how the things that are being proposed are good, that guns should be limited, shouldn't be in the hands of everybody, that there should be restrictions on who should own them, including, you know, raising the age. But he says that they're stopping short. He said demonstrators should seek more effective and more lasting reform, but they should demand a repeal of the Second Amendment. And then he goes on to talk about the history of the Second Amendment, now he's been involved. And he says, during the years when Warren Burger was our Chief Justice, this is 69 to 86, he says, no judge, federal or state, as far as I'm aware, expressed any doubt to the limited coverage of that amendment. And then when organizations like the National Rifle Association disagreed with that position and began their campaign claiming that the federal regulations of firearms curtailed Second Amendment rights, Chief Justice Warren Burger publicly characterized the NRA as perpetuating, quote, one of the greatest pieces of fraud, I repeat the word fraud, on the American public by special interest groups that I have ever seen in my lifetime. Now, in 2008, the court overturned Burger's and others' long settled understanding of the Second Amendment's limited reach by ruling in District of Columbia versus Heller that there was an individual right to bear arms. And Justice Stevens writes, I was one of four dissenters. That decision, which I remain convinced was wrong and certainly debatable, have provided the NRA with a propaganda weapon of immense power. It says, overturning that decision via a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Second Amendment would be simple and would do more to weaken the NRA's ability to stymie legislative debate and block constructive gun control legislation than any other available option. So, you know, going all the way, get rid of the Second Amendment is what this former justice is saying. He's familiar with it. He's been on the court cases. What do you think? 952-946-6205. We'll hear from folks here. We're also here from the White House as well. That question was raised. Sam from New Brighton wants to weigh in on this. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Mike. How are you today?
Hey, I'm doing good. How about yourself?
It's a nice sunny day. Can't beat it. Mike, I think you should absolutely go after the Second Amendment and encourage everybody that believes what they believe to actually state it. I think, you know, for a long, long time, most of the left have wanted to get rid of guns for the most part. They've been trying to play around the edges. And, you know, I think you have to take bold steps if you want to try to get rid of the gun. Be active, be proactive. I mean, everybody knows that guns are dangerous in the wrong hands and stuff. So maybe you should make it so just the government has guns.
Well, I don't think that's the whole idea, but it certainly the way the Constitution was written originally, it was the idea that it was talking about the military. And that was the point of the...
I think it was talking about the states versus the federal government, wasn't it?
Right.
Like the state
well-regulated...
government versus the federal so they wouldn't overcome the states, right?
Well, it was a well-regulated militia, and militias did belong to the states, yes.
Right. So it was the states against an overpowering federal government, right?
Well, I don't know if that was exactly it, but it was certainly, it didn't
have
states'
rights involved.
Well, I don't
think they would have got the 13 colonies to sign up, would you, Mike? I mean, they were kind of,
remember,
kind of particular to not having a federal government or a king-like state, so they all wanted their independence, so I don't think
Sam, just a second. I gotta correct your history here, because when you say the 13 colonies signing up, remember, the Bill of Rights, those first 10 amendments were passed after the Constitution was ratified. So that had nothing to do with anybody signing up to be part of that. So I got to stop you there. I'm going to move on, but I appreciate the engagement on that. Let me just hear quickly. This question was raised at the White House, and I do want to get to more phone calls, but this question was raised at the White House today to Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House press secretary.
Former Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens wrote an op-ed today where he called for the Second Amendment to be repealed. First of all, did the president see that, have a reaction to it? And in the current political climate after Parkland, Florida, does the White House feel there's any chance that that kind of a movement could take hold in Washington?
The president and the administration still fully support the Second Amendment. We think that the focus has to remain on removing weapons from dangerous individuals, not on blocking all Americans from their constitutional rights.
David. So the White House saying no on repealing the Second Amendment. No surprise there. Gary from Minneapolis wants to weigh in on the question. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I guess he said it's archaic 18th century rule, the Second Amendment, the Stevens did. And from what I remember, it was put in there because of from slave revolts. That goes way back to the beginning of our country. You know, the biggest problem they had at the Constitutional Convention, I believe, one of the biggest was Southern states wanted their way with slavery, and then they had a big conflict over it, and they had to learn to live with it, and then eventually it coiled into the Civil War, and it's still with us today, the after shock of that. So they want their Second Amendment rights to have guns to control from slave turmoil. And, I'd like to say hi to Carol out there, too, so if she's listening. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Gary. 952-946-6205. We've got just about a minute left in the show. Pat from St. Paul wanted to jump in. Hey, Pat, what's your thoughts here?
Yeah, I'm okay with the repeal because it just hasn't been interpreted the way it was supposed to. I think, you know, the NRA is basically a gun and ammunition marketing lobby group, and they just want to sell guns, and it's gotten ridiculous. I think it's got to go. I thank you for the time to comment.
All right. Hey, thanks, Pat. 952-946-6205. If you didn't get in on the conversation today on this, I'm sure we'll be continuing this because it's, some would consider it a radical idea. It's a big step. It would take a lot to do it, but if you have some thoughts, give us a call even after the show. We'll record them. We'll play them back here in the days ahead. Again, 952-946-6205. That's it for today's show. I'm back tomorrow. Mike McEntee. Hey, Mom, thank you for listening. And Norman Goldman is up next.